Welcome to this episode of On the Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Anastasia Stratulat. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show. I'm joined here today by Lord Matthew Elliott, who, in essence, needs no introduction since his political influence is hard to ignore. He has been described as one of the most successful political campaigners of Westminster today, having led or founded seven different organizations. Perhaps most prominently, he served as the chief executive of Vote Leave, the official organization advocating for a Leave vote in the 2016 EU membership referendum. Lord Elliott, thank you very much for joining.
It's a pleasure.
The reason I've been wanting to talk to you is because I truly believe in this idea of taking initiative. I think that students at LSE assume a very vocal stance on a variety of issues, while simultaneously having the prerequisite skills to take action. Yet the setback for the majority is not knowing how or not wanting to take the risk to create such a large initiative. I therefore think that you are the best person to give advice on this.
That's very kind.
You have a strong connection to LSE yourself, having graduated from here in the year 2000. What do you remember about your time here?
Well, the big thing I remember from my time at the LSE, and I was there from 97 until 2000, so probably way before many of your listeners were probably born. So it's a very long time ago. But at the time, the place where sort of world politics was thinking about the issue called the Third Way. And the director at the time was Anthony Giddens, who was director of LSE. And he was the guru behind the Third Way. And this is the whole idea that you'd had, you know, the left dominating global politics sort of post-war. Then you'd have the rise of the new right, as they were called. So Margaret Thatcher in the UK and Ronald Reagan in the US and the people across the world. And then you had a sort of stream of leaders in the 1990s who were part of this sort of third way movement. And the whole idea behind that was taking the best bits of the left and the best bits of the new right and melding it together into this more sort of centrist sort of third way approach. And that included everybody from Bill Clinton in the US to Tony Blair in the UK to Gerhard Schroeder in Germany. And the key point was that the LSE was at the centre of all of this because Anthony Giddens, the director, had written this book, The Third Way. So you had all these top politicians from across the world flying in to take part in conferences and give speeches. So really, at the time, LSE felt at the centre of world politics in that way. And you know, that's not unusual for the LSE, being the sort of heart of many sort of big ideas. You know, perhaps it's sort of most well known for, of course, the Fabians, who were very involved in this start back at the beginning of the 20th century, but all the way through to the student protests of the 1960s and 70s, you know, coming from a more left-wing point of view. But of course, you had people in there like Friedrich Hayek, who'd been a lecturer there. So more people on the classical liberal side of things. So as a sort of hotbed of ideas from both the left and the right and the classical liberal side of things and even the sort of centrist side of things, it felt like LSE was the place to be, and I was really grateful for the time I was there. It was really the sort of centre of worldwide attention.
It was, as the Guardian described it, closely wired into Parliament. So has the university's input into the political world helped you in any way?
I think the proximity of the LSE to Westminster really helps. Of course, when people think of, you know, UK universities, they perhaps think more of, you know, Oxford and Cambridge if you're international. But actually, the LSE being a stone's throw from Westminster means you really get, or did at the time, a passage of politicians in and out all the time giving lectures. So from UK politics, that was a great place to be. So when I was doing my sort of student work and sort of setting up the LSE High Society and wanting to have speakers and that sort of thing, it was quite easy to get some really, really top grade speakers who you perhaps otherwise wouldn't get if you weren't based in the centre of London.
As the president of the Hayek Society yourself, I would like to ask whether you consider that university societies are a good way to start addressing issues.
I think Yeah, it's that typical thing about student politics, how people say it's sort of arguing with small differences and lots of arguments. I found it really interesting. I never got involved in sort of party politics, so the sort of I was never part of the LSE Conservatives or any sort of party political group like that. But I felt that the LSE certainly contributed towards the debate within the LSE. We had a magazine called Amogee, which was the oldest word for liberty. And I remember one of the first things I did when I joined the LSE and sort of got signed up by Alistair Heath and Hector Birchwood, who were the founders of the Hayek Society. They got me running off selling adverts for this magazine. So, of course, this was before websites really took off in a big way. And I went around the local restaurants and cafes, and there used to be a bookshop called Scoob Books, I remember, quite close to the LSE. And they do out an advert every year. So go around collecting adverts for this magazine to help finance it. But in our eyes, sort of help put forward the free market message. So we had it full of articles about liberty, classical liberal ideas, free market ideas. And that was great fun. So I'm not sure it made a huge difference, but certainly it helped us put our point of view across. And I think from a sort of professional point of view, actually thinking about how to organise things and how to bring people together and how to organise events and how to organise a magazine and how to finance the magazine, how to fundraise. All of these different skills that I still use this day in many respects with the groups I run, I sort of learned back at the LSE running the Hayek Society.
And as a student at LSE, I can tell from my own experience, you feel the pressure of time passing very quickly these 3 or 4 years. So, looking back at your time there, was there anything that you would have wanted to do differently or earlier?
That's a great question. I think one thing, I could have made better use of my time. I think, like a classic student, I was one of the types who would leave the essay until the last day and then work until sort of 2 a.m. in the morning writing the essay and then handing it in the next day. Looking back, I think we roughly had one essay a week. I could have done working during essentially office hours and basically treating university a bit like an office and going there at 9 a.m. and either going to lectures or classes or doing my sort of work in the library and then clocking off at sort of 6 p.m. and doing a sort of full work day. But of course, that's not the university life, really, is it? You go there and you have a certain amount of socializing and getting to know people and exploring London and all the fun things that come with it. But I could have definitely been more productive with my time in terms of how I organized it and probably doing more work during the day rather than late at night.
I think that's a very common experience because all of us students feel like we're wasting a bit of time, but you have to sacrifice a bit of it for the university life.
Correct.
But I don't think you wasted that much time since only 4 years after you graduated at age 24, you started the Taxpayers Alliance to address the wasteful government spending associated with the early 2000s. So, what were the first steps that you took in launching your first large initiative?
So I'd been graduated for about a year, and this was sort of slightly well into the Tony Blair years by that point. The first Blair term basically had gone along with the Conservative Party spending plans and tax plans. So basically, things were actually still very good in terms of tax and spend. In the second term, after 2001, they basically started increasing spending and increasing taxes. And that's and at such a pace, you start to see government waste. And this hugely frustrated me, sort of seeing money being wasted. And this wasn't really being talked about. There was the odd article in the press every now and again, but nobody's really addressing this as an issue. And certainly the Conservative Party weren't. And they were going through a phase where they felt they had to match Labour Party spending plans to get back into office. So they weren't putting across the message that money was being wasted. So I could see the need for a group to talk about this. And I was working in Parliament at the time for actually for an MEP, but I had a desk in Parliament, sort of working for an MP, so it was a bit slightly hybrid. And for a whole year, I basically started collecting evidence of government waste. So I would go to the library in the House of Commons, ones that researchers can go to, and I would look through the papers every day, and I would actually sort of go and photocopy articles which were to do with government waste. And I would go through the written questions in Hansard, the parliamentary report, and basically look at examples of government waste and again sort of photocopy them or rip out the pages and put them in a binder. And after the course of a year, I basically had all the material I needed for the first bumper book of government waste, which basically identified £50 billion worth of money that I felt had been wasted over the course of the past year. So in a sense, this we hear a lot about Doge now, what Elon Musk is doing with President Trump's administration. Of course, he has the advantage of all the computer coders and AI and all the other skills he has on his plate, all I at the time is basically a pile of newspapers, a pile of Hansard, a photocopier, and I was really compiling it all by hand to come up with this example of government waste. But what it meant was that we had, for the first time ever, a very rich source of information about how money could be better spent. And we compiled that into our first bumper book, and we used that as a basis for the launch of the Taxpayers Alliance. So there was the research side going on there, but also it was the organizational side. So setting up as a not-for-profit company, setting up a website, collecting together a sort of advisory council, raising some money, setting up some events, all those sort of things I'd learned at the LSE with the Hike Society, I was then transferring to the Taxpayers Alliance to set up a new organization. But really, it all started in Parliament as a researcher, doing a lot of the work on the side there, and then leaving once the TPA had been launched.
And if I remember correctly, you were inspired by the groups in the US representing the taxpayers' opinions on issues.
That's correct. So the US has quite a sort of well-established network of taxpayer groups, and all of them do slightly different things. So there's one that specialised in government waste. There's one that specialised in the sort of level of and type of taxation. There's one more about sort of bringing together different sort of free market groups. So all the different things. And I tried to take the best bits I like from each one to put it into the Taxpayers Alliance. But it should also be said, and this is really important, that there was a very active, and still is, a very active French taxpayers group, a very active one in Germany as well. It's very well established, particularly in the southern Germany and the Bavarian part. So it's not unique to the US. There were taxpayer groups elsewhere across Europe, which I also looked at.
Very interesting to hear, and it was very good to hear that the society you are part of helped you in this. So LSE is a university which encourages students to be vocal about issues that concern them. And you can find, I'm sure it was quite the same in your years there, advertisements of different issues and initiatives all around campus. Yet few stop to look, including myself. I'm guilty of this. And you once said that the message sent through the Taxpayers Alliance is the same as that sent by many other groups. You argue that the difference is in the way in which it is packaged and sold to the media. So is it what you advertise or how you advertise it?
It's a mixture of both, and in some ways, the Taxpayers Alliance revolutionised how third-party work in the UK was done. So before the TPA, you had lots of think tanks on both the left and the right who would produce very long, worthy reports that would land on the desk of a journalist. And if you're a journalist, you basically wouldn't know what to do with it because it was such a long report and had so many facts and figures in there. It didn't really sell a story or tell a story or explain how it fitted in with a wider campaign. And what we did at the TPA was essentially, rather than doing long reports like that, we would basically work out very newsworthy facts and figures and package them up into shorter reports, which were more worthy of newspaper stories. So we basically repackaged the whole idea. Rather than doing one long report over the course of a year, we basically did 12 shorter reports to get more impact in the media, but also get better chance of getting the papers. It was an easier message. It was more sort of headline grabbing message. And you now see all the think tanks do this in how they sell their research and to get more publicity. But we revolutionized all of that. And I think that's one of the ways we made a very big impact on a small budget with a small members of staff to have a better way of communicating with people. But it wasn't just the means of communication, it was also sort of how we put things together in a very easy to digest way. Let's not forget, journalists have so much pressure on their hands, and even more so now than it was 20 years ago, to be frank. But now, there are articles to write if you're a print journalist. They probably do podcasts like this one as well, if you're a journalist. They're tweeting all day as well. So they do all these different things, these different activities. If you go back, let's say 50 years, could be a journalist who'd work on one story a week because newspapers sold a lot more copies. Now you can't do that. So you really need to make sure that when you're selling in a story to the press, it really is very crisply done in a way which the journalist can easily translate into an article.
I completely agree. Having such a large initiative at this early age, what were some of the challenges you faced?
I think the biggest one to overcome was the lack of a track record. So when I started the fundraising for it, I was asking for some quite large sums of money from people. And what they could see is somebody who just graduated from university and had 2 years under their experience. So I was actually trying to convince them that it was well worth putting money into. And I was helped by recruiting, as part of one of the co-founders, a friend called Andrew Allam, who was probably about 10 years older than me. He was a partner at a management consultancy firm, more experienced, more professional, more experienced in his belt. So the combination of both of us with some others, I think, showed we had some experience. But then it was a matter of getting those quick wins, so getting those stories into the papers, show the impact we were having to people, showing them that our project was worth supporting, raising some more money, hiring some more staff, and having that virtuous circle starting. You still have that same problem whenever you do this, but now I've got a bit more experience, a bit more track record. People can see what my approach is. They know I execute well, so it's easier on that front. But then again, in some ways, the ambitions I do now are bigger. So the projects are bigger, the staffing's bigger, so there's more money to raise and more to do. But really, the big difficulty at the beginning was that lack of experience. But I got over that by basically showing a very easy, quick, immediate track record of impact.
Very interesting. So, fast forward 20 years, a hot topic with regards to tax following the 2024 autumn budget is the increase in capital gain tax. How do you think that this will affect business owners in the UK or the UK in general?
Really badly. I think the autumn budget was the most anti-business budget I've seen for decades. It's during my time in politics, frankly. If you look back at the Blair Brown budgets when they were in government, they actually had some actually quite business-friendly policies and entrepreneur-friendly policies, and tax breaks for entrepreneurs and that sort of thing. It really helped the UK economy really motor in those late 90s, early 2000s. So they got that. I don't think that Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves get it in the same way at the moment. And certainly, of course, this adds to, I'm not trying to make a partisan point here, but really what we've seen over the past period, frankly, since 2010, is the gradual increase in government spending and increase in taxation. And that hasn't helped. That's why the UK now has such a high tax burden, and that's not helping business. So what really makes me afraid is that people start thinking, if you're entrepreneurial, why not go overseas? So when I go to Dubai, as I do regularly, or America, as I do regularly, I see lots of Brits working out there and setting up businesses and being entrepreneurial. And I want those British people working in the UK, setting up businesses here and providing jobs here. And that's where they should be. But we need to make sure there's the right business environment here in the UK for them to fulfill their ambitions. And that's one of the key challenges facing politics at the moment.
I 100% agree. Something very interesting I've been following recently is your recent initiative, the Jobs Foundation, which seeks to shed light on this idea of using business as a force for good to bring people from deprived backgrounds into jobs. Would you mind telling us a little bit more about this initiative?
So this is very different to my previous initiatives, not least because it's a charity rather than a sort of think tank or campaign group. And one of the big issues facing the country at the moment is underemployment or worklessness. And we haven't seen the rise in employment post-COVID than you had pre-COVID. So basically, the government, quite rightly, this is one of the good things the government is doing. It has the agenda of getting the employment rate back up to 80%, which means getting 2 million people from welfare into work. It's really good they're doing this. And Liz Kendall, the welfare secretary, will be producing a green paper on this very soon. It's great they're doing this. And we want to be part of that effort in a couple of ways. First of all, in identifying how businesses can best transition people from welfare into work, and looking at the best practice in this area, so looking at the very best businesses that concentrate on poverty hotspots, or the very best businesses that concentrate on various disadvantaged groups. So, many people walk in London will walk past a Timpsons every day that cuts your keys and fixes your shoes and what have you. A lot of those are staffed by ex-offenders. That's part of their model, and it's been very successful. And it's a great social enterprise as well as being a great business, a very profitable business. So we want to sort of put a spotlight on that best practice within the UK and help other companies follow suit. But at the same time, you need the business community to be thriving. So as well as doing that practical side of our work, getting people from welfare into work, we want to push to make sure that the UK has a very good business environment. And that's where the policy side of the work comes in terms of making sure that we have business-friendly, entrepreneurial-friendly policies here in the UK.
And how are businesses able to accommodate these underprivileged individuals in the industry?
Very good point. So a lot of them have apprenticeship schemes. A lot of them have general entry level jobs, and then associated with training schemes that kick in and help people advance their skill base and advance up through the company. And what strikes me is every business I go to, but in a sense, particularly family businesses, they have a very nurturing, paternalistic relationship with their employees. And they're really proud of the people they've taken on and helped to gain in skills and help to advance in life and help provide their families. And that's a big part of their story and a big reason why they're proud to be business owners. And that, in some ways, is very different to the picture of the business leader you often get in the media, which is very different to somebody who's just in it for the profits and just wanting to cut all costs at all costs. That's not the business leader I come across. So really, I want to support the good work that businesses already do in terms of lifting people out of poverty. And we shouldn't forget that basically the business community and the jobs they provide are the biggest mechanism for alleviating poverty there ever is, not just in the UK, across the world. So we should be encouraging businesses to do more good in this area.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I think that the benefits of businesses is an area quite overlooked. I could tell from my perspective of taking company law, we always look at what the businesses do wrong and not what they can be used for to create good impact.
Good.
And in launching this group, you carried out an outreach program with business leaders across the UK to test the hypothesis that the Jobs Foundation was needed. What was it that urged these leaders to reach this mutual conclusion?
So ahead of setting up any new group, I've really learned this over the years. It wasn't as detailed as this in the early days, but now I try and do it now. Is to really try and understand the policy area, because I may feel passionate about a cause, and I may have reasons why I'm really passionate about it, but that may not be the reason why other people are interested in the topic or why the public are moved by a certain topic. So I try and do research to try and find out what other people are thinking about the same issue. And we did two key pieces of research ahead of setting up the Jobs Foundation. One was to understand what business leaders thought about the role of business in society. And the second piece was to understand what voters or members of the public thought about the role of business in society. And that really gave us a very good grasp of what people liked and disliked about businesses. And one really interesting thing that came out, and this actually inspired the name, was that the number one thing that people like about business is, of course, they want businesses to provide good quality products at reasonable prices. That's the key thing that people want from a business or services. But the second thing they want from businesses is the creation and provision of jobs. They actually recognize that's a really important thing that businesses do for society. And that's partly what the motivation behind calling ourselves the Jobs Foundation, to actually really highlight that central thing that businesses do in terms of finding jobs. But we're also recognize the other important things they do in terms of providing training. The huge amounts of tax that businesses pay. We shouldn't forget that basically every pound that the government or local government in the UK spends essentially starts with a business. Because it's not just the corporation tax that businesses pay or the business rates that businesses pay. But it's also the tax that individuals pay, because when a company pays an employee, and then the employee pays national insurance and pays income tax, that money has been generated by the business. So really, we need a thriving business community to make sure that we have a thriving and successful and well-funded public sector.
Thank you very much. It sounds very interesting, and I'm very excited to follow what will happen with this foundation.
Thank you.
Having discussed your first and your latest initiative, I would like to now turn to what could perhaps be regarded as your most well-known role as chief executive of the Vote Leave campaign, which stemmed from your prior Business for Britain campaign group. So, of course, at the time, everyone was talking about Brexit, and surely there were many different groups with its stance on this issue. So, what would you say made Vote Leave reach this level of influence, such as to effectively overshadow the other groups?
Well, it's interesting. When I set up Business for Britain, which was the foundation for Vote Leave, there were other groups talking about Brexit. And of course, you had the different think tanks who were talking about it, some extremely good ones. And of course, you had the Nigel Farage's UK Independence Party, UKIP, campaigning on the issue. So you had different groups involved. But you didn't really have a group for business leaders who are interested in the economics of our relationship with the EU. And one crucial point is that we set up not with a Brexit mandate, but with a mandate to say that David Cameron was right to say there should be a referendum on Britain's membership of the EU, because that's something they could unify around. People agreed on that. And they also agreed on the idea that from his Bloomberg speech, that we needed to take powers back from the EU and put them back at the UK level. So that's the second thing they agreed on. But at that point, it wasn't necessarily a Brexit group. But I think by establishing ourselves as being within the mainstream, being business-backed, being focused on the economic aspect of this debate, that really laid the foundations for us being able to sort of set up Vote Leave, but also being able to attract some very mainstream senior business leaders, like, so politicians like Boris Johnson and Michael Gove and Gisela Stuart, who came on board because they trust us and saw us being a sort of sensible, mainstream, pragmatic group to join. So really, it started a long way off from the 2015-2016 period. It started really way back in 2012, the whole setting up it. And that's one of the sort of key lessons to learn from campaigning and influencing things, is trying to spot those trends ahead of time to set up the group or organisation that could help shape and mould the both the public opinion around it, but also the political and media opinion around it. So when the issue actually comes to the fore, you're really well placed to actually be the group who's defining how things should be done.
And what were some of the public challenges associated with leading a group of such high caliber?
Oh, I mean, the whole referendum period, in a sense, went by in a blink, because I don't think many people thought that David Cameron was going to win in 2015, and then that triggered the referendum, and then it happened within a year. And there's a long period of time when he was in the negotiations and the referendum hadn't officially started, and we were busy trying to sort of set up. But really, that year went by extremely quickly. It was difficult in a sense in managing lots of different egos, frankly, of the people involved and also different groups involved, and trying to bring them together in common cause. That was a really tough thing to do. But then again, that was also our strength, in the sense that we had lots of different people involved and they could all speak in different ways to different groups. We talked before about having the importance of messaging, and the fact is, when you're motivating people in a referendum and trying to sort of get over that 50% mark, people will be motivated by different arguments and different reasons for voting leave or remain. So actually having several voices speaking and saying slightly different things sometimes actually helped to encourage different groups of voters to come out on our side.
Very interesting to learn about this. And you once mentioned that we haven't made as many opportunities as we might have done out of Brexit. Could you please elaborate on that?
So Brexit's a process, and some people sort of mistakenly think it was completed in 2016 when we voted to leave. But of course, that was the start of the process. And then, of course, you had Theresa May's time in office, and Boris Johnson came along and got Brexit done, and we sort of finally left at the end of January in 2020. At that point, of course, we're in the very early days of COVID, and that was just starting to emerge. And I think it was sort of mid-February when the first cases happened in Northern Italy, and then very soon came over to the UK as well. So immediately you went from having that sort of legal break from us leaving the EU officially to being straight into that COVID period, which lasted intensely for 2 years, and we're still facing the sort of tail end of that period in terms of the economy recovering. So in an ideal world, we would have left the EU at the end of January 2020. And then Boris Johnson would be able to really sort of think, okay, what's the vision for Britain post-Brexit? What does that mean for us in terms of our foreign policy and the groups we want to be involved in? What does it mean for us in terms of our domestic policy and how we can actually take advantage of the new powers we have to change aspects of British law, EU law, which we sort of disagree with? Where does Britain want to go? But of course, he lost all that momentum with COVID. That's not to say that good things haven't happened. We've got a certain number of trade deals, which have been very good. More can be done in that area. We've saved a huge bunch of money, which has been spent in the UK, which is great. It also means that, for example, live issues like the whole question of whether or not Donald Trump will have a trade war against Europe. Now, if it's against the European Union, we have the ability to escape that by controlling our own trade policy. So we may get an advantage from that, see how things happen. So I still think it's been massively worthwhile, and I'm pleased we voted to leave the EU, and there have been benefits from it. But there's a lot more we can do building on what we've done already.
Thank you. Now I would like to move on to discuss one of your groups, which I think would be particularly interesting, especially for the law students. In 2009, you founded the prominent Big Brother Watch, through which you addressed issues including state surveillance and the use of intrusive communication interception powers through legislation such as the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act. Could you please tell us more about the achievements of this group?
So Big Brother Watch, I set up, it must have been sort of 5 years after the start of the Taxpayers Alliance. I can't remember the dates now. It was roughly sort of 5 years after it. And what really motivated me to set it up were two issues which were very live at the time. One was the whole question, which was slightly tailing off by that point, but the question, should there be ID cards in the UK? And in Britain, we never had a tradition of ID cards, so that would have been a big change. So I was against that. And then also the issue of CCTV. And certainly at the time, and it feels like we're still in that situation, the UK has more CCTV cameras than any country in the world. So you practically can't work anywhere without being filmed. And that really concerned me. So I saw the need for a civil liberties group to actually sort of use some of the lessons I'd learned from the Taxpayers Alliance in terms of campaigning and getting coverage for issues and persuading the public. Putting it more in a sort of civil liberty setting. So I set up Big Brother Watch, and it had some great successes in terms of the publicity and highlighting issues. I then moved on in the sense I was doing Brexit and the referendum, and it was under great leadership in the sense of Nick Pickles was one of the directors, and he went on to head up public policy for Twitter. And then worked for a number of years for a year after Elon Musk took over at X. Worked for Elon Musk, so he went on to do great things. But it was handed over in a sense to people with great, standing who were able to run it themselves. And is now, of course, doing a lot of issues in terms of the. He was very anti-lockdown during the COVID period. Now, of course, it's a lot on tech and tech surveillance, which is a really important issue. So it raises a whole bunch of interesting and important issues, and does in such a way that I think really is able to. Mobilize a lot of people and build up coalitions and also have a big impact. So I'm very proud to have set it up. But it's not an issue which I follow in a huge amount of detail now because I'm focused on other things.
Thank you very much. Perhaps we can agree that some level of surveillance may be required in maintaining an organized society, but where exactly do you consider we should draw this line with regards to the depth of surveillance?
It's a really interesting question. I think I probably changed my mind on things like, for example, ID cards since setting up Big Brother Watch. I haven't thought enough about the issue in recent years. It hasn't been a live issue politically, so this isn't a definitive position, but just spitballing for a second. I think I probably changed my mind because, in a sense, back in the days when we set up Big Brother Watch, the big live issue that people were thinking about was really, in a sense, state surveillance. So the state look at your ID card, or the state having access to CCTV, and that was the big issue. But of course, what's very, very apparent now is that really the biggest tool of surveillance isn't CCTV, or indeed a very limited ID card with limited data on there. It's basically our mobile phones, and basically all of the interactions we have with the outside world through our mobile phones, and how that's used and tracked, and all the data there. I haven't thought about the issue in enough detail to know where to draw the line. What I would say is I'd like to see a lot more transparency on this. And when I hear this issue come up in the House of Lords, it does quite regularly in question time and debates. Often it feels like sometimes both the government and tech companies are sort of slightly hiding behind privacy notices and confidentiality notices, and it's not clear basically where the line has been drawn. And I'd say that one thing which I've learned across all the public policy areas I've worked on, including government spending and waste, is basically transparency is so important. So I'd like to see more transparency so people know what's happening with their information, where the line has been drawn, and therefore people can make more informed decisions about what they choose to do on their iPhone when they're using it, and what have you.
I completely agree, and I think that this group is especially relevant in today's increasingly technological
Yeah.
world. So you founded groups tackling a range of seemingly contrasting issues, including fiscal matters, civil liberties, the role of business in society. So what I'm curious about, were these areas that you had prerequisite skills and knowledge in? Or did you rather think of these issues from the standpoint of a citizen?
I basically started with a blank sheet of paper. There were all issues where I was very interested in them and felt very passionately about the issue and wanted to do something about the issue. But I didn't necessarily have a big depth of knowledge in terms of the precise details of the public policy around it. But I always had a passionate interest in the issue. And that's, in a sense, what sets me apart from being a traditional lobbyist. So I always get really annoyed when people sort of say, "Oh, you're a lobbyist," and that sort of thing. I'm not. So I basically pick the issue and then build up a coalition around it that I genuinely believe in, rather than sort of setting up a group because I've been paid to do it. So I campaign in that respect. So I haven't always had a very deep knowledge about the matter, but I've always been passionate about it. But in setting it up, I've learned a lot about it. So always within, 6 months, a year in, I'll be quite au fait about the subject.
Yeah, I think that's very encouraging because in many cases, individuals may be concerned about certain issues and they may think that they don't have the enough knowledge on the subject to do something about it. So it's very encouraging.
Good.
So, having considered a part of your initiatives, I would like to now go back to the LSE students and how they can make an impact. So, you've mentioned that when you see an issue you want solved, you feel the desire to set up a group to represent that issue. I suppose many have the idea to do something or are clearly concerned about something, yet they have no idea to start. What advice would you give them?
Well, the good news is that it's basically become easier than ever to have a voice in a debate. Thinking back to when I started in the world of politics, so for example, the first think tank I interned in when I was at the LSE in the late 1990s, and just sort of paint a picture for people. I think it's really important this. As a think tank, we produced a monthly journal which we posted out to people. We would send our press releases to journalists by fax. Of course, lots of phone calls and that sort of thing. I remember about sort of six of us in the think tank, the head of research had an email, and he basically used his personal email address as the email address for the organisation. So it was a very, very different world to now. And of course, crucially, people were based in, bricks and mortar offices, and you had all the costs associated with that. So actually, campaigning was a very expensive thing to do. Whereas now, of course, you can see people online who feel passionately about something, and essentially by setting up Twitter or X account, they can start campaigning on the issue and start to talk about the issue and associate with a Substack and doing a podcast and doing some YouTube videos from their iPhone. Very quickly and cheaply, you could actually start campaigning on a group. Now, of course, the downside of that is that basically because it's so cheap and easy to do now, many more people are doing it. So you have that cacophony of voices across the online world of everybody having their say. So in a sense, it's more difficult to get cut through now than it was. So everything has its sort of pros and cons, but in terms of setting something up, you can do it in a more cost-effective way than you could previously. This is where having a sort of distinctive message comes in and having a sort of clear pitch to people. And also, the crucial ingredient is persistence. And if I look at basically who's successful in politics at shaping policy and gaining advancement within politics, persistence is a big thing, and basically just sticking at it. And you have some tough times and some good times and times when things are going well, and you may have to sort of slightly refine ideas. And take for example the Jobs Foundation. That went through at least two, possibly even three iterations of name before we launched. So the internal name we were using as a working title sort of thing went through several iterations before we hit on the right one of the Jobs Foundation. So you have to be flexible as well. But I would say the good news is that for people who want to do something, who want to make a difference, they can set something up cheaply using the online world.
Very interesting. Yet in 2004, when you started your first large project, you didn't have this platform of social media. So how did you go around finding the right group of people?
So really then that was we had a website where we launched, people signed up by the website, and we quickly built it into being I think about 10,000 people over the course of a year. But that's why we relied really heavily on the newspapers at the time and getting broadcast media from that. Now, of course, it's changed. So things back in the day, 20 years ago, were still very newspaper driven in the UK, and even the BBC, which was still the biggest sort of source of news people, really took their news from their lead from the newspapers. So getting the influence of the newspapers is really important. Now that's still important to get your voice out there. But really the online world is even more important, and it's really picking the right online platform. So for example, with the Jobs Foundation, we found this very untrendy and unsexy. We found LinkedIn to be great because, of course, on there it's more professionals, business people on there. I'd say the debate is more sensible and rational, and you're less aggressive than on Twitter. So that's been the best means for us. So it's finding the right sort of nook to get through. But yeah, you've got to be flexible. That's the key. Flexible and be adaptable.
Thank you very much. And you've once mentioned that if you want to make an impact, you have to aim for a full spectrum solution. And as you said, bite more off than you can chew. So taking such large initiatives evidently requires a high level of risk. And this might be a large setback for many people who are looking to start something of their own. What advice would you give them?
I think with any issue area, to get a change in policy, you do need to be full spectrum. So basically, you need to have everything covered from the weighty academic type documents with the clear thinking in it, to the more newsworthy reports, to the nowadays the online content down to the tweets. So, to the parliamentary activity, targeting parliamentarians, to targeting civil servants, to targeting journalists more widely and opinion voices more widely, to targeting the public and building them into a coalition. So, there are all sorts of activities based in terms of building a movement which can actually create change in any area. And the trick is to really work out in an area what are the groups and individuals out there already and what they're doing, and find your niche. So, you won't necessarily straight away do everything. Or if you try to do everything, as I sometimes did in my early career, you won't achieve anything. So to find that niche and find that sort of that way in, and you may set up an organization specialize in perhaps doing the online content. But over time, you feel that some more serious work needs to be done. So you perhaps sort of sponsor some research from a university or something. And then you perhaps feel that an effort needs to be done to influence parliamentarians. So you build an effort to talk to MPs and that sort of thing. So building over time to be full spectrum is important. But in any policy area, to get that difference, it does need a full spectrum approach. But it doesn't necessarily need to be one person or one group doing it.
This is all very interesting. Thank you very much. So, to finish, I would just like to ask perhaps some the questions didn't explore enough. Is there any last piece of advice you would like to give to LSE students or students in general?
That's a good question. I think it comes back to this point about persistence and sticking at something. This is going to be a bit of a segue, but it's quite fun to finish on a segue. One of my favourite pieces of music is by Herbert Howells, who is an English composer, basically from the Victorian, basically, but slightly after the war as well. And he wrote a Te Deum, which is part of the service at Matins. And it was written for King's College Cambridge Choir. And it was called the Collegium Regale Te Deum. And the final line of it is, "Let me never be confounded." And that's always struck me as quite sort of appropriate phrase to think about. Never let me be confounded. And what that basically means is, yes, you'll go through tough times and face difficulties, but you're not being bewildered or perplexed or dumbfounded by things, which is generally what the word means, is a really important thing. So, yeah, that's the sort of my wish to everybody who's in the sort of campaigning world, they're not confounded by the problems. They sort of persist and just sort of carry on through to their campaigning objectives that are completed.
Thank you very much, and thank you again for joining us today. I hope the other students, and I'm sure they will learn as much as I did from you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.